You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being done late in the evening of April 2nd, 2025. We're going to go to a familiar topic. It's a familiar topic because it's of extraordinary importance. We're dealing with lessons that the regime can't learn. It's not that they don't have the ability. They can't. Academics refuse to really talk about it, at least not systematically. And it comes down to the U.S. as a paper tiger, both militarily and economically. The reduction of the American empire to regional status. There's a big difference between the American empire and the regime. They're very closely related, but the regime is far more than just American. And of course, the foil for all of this is China. For many years, before anybody else on the nationalist right, alt-right, alternative media was talking about it, Willis Cardo and myself were talking about China as a national socialist state in a very broad sense of that word. And that's probably about right. That's socialism with Chinese characteristics. And it's come up more with the rhetoric coming from the White House. In 2016, Donald Trump campaigned, at least in part, on the concept that China stole American jobs. You know, that didn't help his reputation by saying idiotic things like that. Nothing was stolen. U.S. government actually subsidized through insurance plans from the Export-Import Bank. OPIC, all these other institutions to take advantage of lower cost labor abroad, and not just China, but elsewhere. But on March 5th, the clueless BBC, in her print edition, said that acting like this is just from out of nowhere, that China has warned the U.S. is ready to fight any type of war. And that's talking about the tariff issue. And the Chinese are absolutely correct. They are far more ready than anyone else. Trade war, the Americans, Donald Trump included, seem to think that the U.S. is in a position where sanctions really will matter that much. You know, this isn't Mexico we're talking about, who's totally dependent on the U.S. China isn't really dependent on the U.S. at all. The Chinese retaliated 15% tariffs on various agricultural products. It's all agribusiness anyway. The Chinese embassy said that, well, if war is what the Americans want, tariff war, trade war, or anything else, we're ready to fight to the end. And we know that the Americans are not ready to fight to the end. They're not ready to fight, and certainly not to the end. And it's significant because the National People's Congress just ended in Beijing. And this is where some of the policy was formulated. That same day, March 5th, BBC wrote, China's premier, Li Qiang, announced that China would again boost its defense spending by 7.2% this year and warned that changes, unseen in a century, were unfolding across the world at a faster pace. This increase was expected and matches a figure announced last year. China sent a message to the people of China that they are confident and that the country's economy can grow, even with the threat of a trade war. China has been keen to portray an image of being a stable, peaceful country in contrast to the U.S., with Beijing accuses of being embroiled in wars in the Middle East and Ukraine. Accuses. These are facts that no one can deny. China doesn't need the U.S. for its economy to grow. China is a stable, peaceful country outside of American provocations. And how do you accuse the U.S. of being embroiled in wars in the Middle East and Ukraine? That's why I say that these people are simply idiots. The only country that's going to be harmed by any kind of tariffs. I mean, normally I was a big fan of protectionism. But keep in mind, these are American companies, for the most part, in China that they're talking about. Only the U.S. is going to be harmed by these actions. Remember, any foreign investment, and they want to attract more foreign investment, it's always going to be on China's terms, because the state is more powerful than its economic power. There are very few places where that's the case. The U.S. is the oligarchy. China is ready to go to war. It's in far better shape than the United States. Of course, because the U.S. are engaging in all kinds of drills and games, President Xi is doing the exact same thing. And somehow, and this is laughable, that the U.S., I don't know if the Trump administration specifically, trying to blame China for the fentanyl thing. And somehow that's the flimsy excuse to raise tariffs on Chinese imports. So far, nothing is new here. It started off cordially enough. Donald Trump and Xi had a phone call. There was supposed to be another one. It didn't happen. China's economy is infinitely more stable than the United States, far more productive and larger. And it's larger, regardless whether you use purchasing power. It's definitely the biggest economy in the world if you use PPP. But even without it, because they actually produce things. It's not a financialized economy, and that's what the state does. It maintains its course. The American defense budget is over $1 trillion a year. I exposed that several years ago because the official number in the budget, in the actual document, is the defense budget is all over the place. It's not just in the Defense Department part of the document. So it's at least $1 trillion a year. The U.S., as we all know, surrounded China with military bases, especially in, many in Japan and the Philippines, many on the Pacific Islands, like Guam and the Marshall Islands, Southeast Asia. And apparently, I don't know where they're getting this money from, but more Air Force bases are going to be constructed over the next decade. Beyond all that, the U.S. infiltrates Chinese regions like Tibet, hoping to start a civil war, engaging in a propaganda offensive against the PRC. They still believe this Tiananmen Square massacre actually occurred. It never happened. Making matters worse, there's going to be a civilian port, and that's in big quotes, in the northernmost islands in the Philippines, pretty much halfway from between the top part of the Philippines and the Republic of China. This is the Pattanes Islands, actually even less than 125 miles from Taiwan. It's considered a choke point. Philippines and those islands are always, extremely important. But a civilian port is probably a CIA station or something similar. But of course, it's a choke point to not just anywhere, but the South China Sea, which is contested only because the United States says so. It's already a key waterway. The U.S. poses as peacemakers. They want stability and freedom of navigation. Actually, the U.S. Navy says it's about control, not freedom of navigation. The South China Sea has China in the name, and the overwhelming majority of the navigation taking place in that sea is Chinese. There are 120 countries that have China as their largest trading partner, including Taiwan and Japan. China completely dominates the South China Sea because it's Chinese. And it's a very important aspect of all of the East Asian economies, almost all of which have China as its number one dominant trading partner. So, the regime is continuing to build its presence. northernmost part of the Philippines, going as close to the island as they can, they're threatening Chinese shipping. They're not protecting anything. Now, the U.S. isn't capable of taking substantial action. We're going to talk about that here in a minute. But it's going to hurt all of the countries, that 120 countries that have China as their number one, and many of them, of course, in Asia. In all the documents, in all the war games, and all of the discussions, and CSIS and other groups like that, the disruption of Chinese commerce is a key element. It appears over and over again. This so-called civilian port is just another step towards war with China, a war that the U.S. not only couldn't win, but they would be defeated very quickly. Mike Whitney wrote on March 3rd, I want to quote him here in this regard, because I've been saying this forever, but he says, "The U.S. has abandoned all hope of prevailing over China through conventional free market competition. Instead, the U.S. plans to engage China militarily in a desperate attempt to drain its resources, garner broader support for economic sanctions, and isolate China from its regional trading partners. It's a risky and disruptive plan that could backfire spectacularly, but Washington is moving forward regardless. U.S. foreign policy mandarins and their globalist allies will not accept an outcome in which China is the world's largest and most powerful economy." Well, it is the world's largest and most powerful economy, the most productive economy. And it's going to be very difficult for them to do much about that. The U.S. is not an industrial power. It is completely financialized. This Wall Street speculation. The economy is based on debt leveraging scams. We talked about derivatives on this show many times. Diverting trillions in not just unproductive activities, but very risky. There's no production involved. The underlying asset is not really even owned by the speculator. But on top of that, of course, since the 70s, the U.S. has hollowed out. Tens of thousands of factories have relocated to places. Because the state is completely captured by the oligarchy, this is why the regime is what it is. The state is the bodyguard of capital and nothing else. There's been an increase. The Congress in China was going on. In attacks on China, and certainly Xi. And it's, given what Johnson's law is, obscure leaders are much easier to demonize. You know, Gaddafi, Milosevic, and Xi is certainly one. The only people who can't see this pattern are Western academics. As I've said 1,000 times, you know, it's the same pattern. They just fill in the blanks. Different country, different name. The same slanders, the same nonsense. Now, it's another matter, though, whether or not the U.S. would risk everything in a war on China that it cannot win. And it's not just a military concern. Let's be clear, and I've said this before, Chinese imports are from American firms. So in this case, even a trade war is irrational. You're not putting sanctions on foreign companies. If the U.S. decides to impose tariffs on China or continues to do so, American companies operating in China, that's 60% of China's exports to the U.S., at least, that's actually a few years old, they would be hurt the most. Now, the point is to bring them home, but the infrastructure and labor isn't here for any kind of, we're talking about factories here, productive places. There's a huge lobby that they're not going to, you know, the currency is under state control. Strictly, that's something that drives the oligarchs crazy. They control the currency in the West. Chinese profit margins remain fairly low. The only people who are making a killing is foreign companies investing in China. Yes, they have to share profits, certainly. That's done on Chinese terms. But it's anywhere from 1.7% to 1.9%. The twisted thing is that the companies who hollowed out entire states, entire cities, big factories leaving, destroying entire areas, those same people who were dispossessed are the same people who were buying stuff from the factories that moved over there, The price doesn't change. The price, if anything, is going to go up. But their profits go up because they have to pay less and labor. And labor is docile, at least for now. Multinational corporations are the only ones who win. And yet, Donald Trump, on every campaign, China's stealing jobs, somehow. Well, the drive to war from the regime, or Washington for that matter, yeah, it's over the size, the relative size of the economies, because the size of these economies, and especially their productivity, implies something. It implies that the Chinese state has the power to resist the foreign oligarchs' attempts to take over. These billionaires want to be able to take over, as they've done almost everywhere else. The party government is not based on the profits of foreign capital in China, as it is in Washington. Whitney made a very great point. He said Washington has no response to the Belt and Road Project. No vision for the future whatsoever. But when you consider the derivative, risky, essentially junk bond mentality of the American economy, well, the future is something that's very short. It makes sense. Back in 2016, now you know I have a China book coming out, which has been delayed. It's been delayed for a very good reason, because I'm also writing a book on now that the Russo-Ukrainian war is coming to an end, I need to write a book on that. There's no one else who could do it like I can. And I want to read, I don't know if I ever specifically did this, but this will be a part of the book, but I wrote in various essays back actually earlier than 2016. I published them then, or finished them then. Probably goes back farther than that. The regime's press reports that there's a possibility of a recession in the U.S. constantly. When such terms are redefined and manipulated, they can refer to anything. The truth is that the U.S. has been in a depression since at least 2008, and there seems to be no way of getting out. Private sector debt is fast approaching $20 trillion. By the way, it's grown a lot since then, not including the massive interest to be added over the foreseeable future. Given that war with either Russia or China would be suicidal for the U.S., let alone fighting both together, the only rational reading of the regime's provocation on both fronts is the possibility of unifying the country for the sake of economic recovery, as well as, and more importantly, as we already read, to damage its competitors. Now, Roosevelt did the same thing in 1941 against an equally stubborn depression. Unfortunately for the U.S. today, FDR had a relatively unified nation, a basically moral people, and a national civic will that made that kind of unity a reasonable expectation, despite the fact that they were on the wrong side of that war. The national leadership was seen by the population as basically legitimate. Solidarity existed at racial, religious, and cultural levels, although because of World War II, that was not going to last. The USA is a country. There is no interest served in a war with anyone, and certainly should not have a military presence in South Asia or the Baltics, for example. All of these places are more than willing to trade with the U.S., so the purpose of the military in these places can only be for exploitation, to protect the massive investments, ultimately destroying the U.S. economy through offshoring, its corporate welfare of the worst and most expensive kind. And of course, in addition, it's to damage this Chinese monster that they cannot control. The U.S. also has no true interest in who controls the South China Sea, in the same way as she had no interest in the Japanese East Asian co-prosperity sphere. Japan's rise to power after 1900 made her the natural leader of East Asia, the same position China's in today. There's no moral issue one way or the other with these countries being regional hegemons, except that it vitiates American domination of the terms of trade and represents the political side of the massive growth of the East Asian economies, having long eclipsed the U.S. In 2013, the Philippines took China to the International Tribunal on the Law of the Sea concerning limits of the Chinese maritime border. Now, any idiot should know that Manila would never take such provocative action without American backing. And of course, it was the U.S. masquerading as the Philippines, suing China through the agency of the Paul Richler of the Boston law firm Foley Hogue. But of course, the American press took the State Department at its word and supported its legal position. Well, China sits on the UN Security Council, so the Philippine victory was of no true interest to anyone. And the UN has no authority in the area or anywhere else, for that matter. So the legal defeat was totally ignored. But what the Council on Foreign Relations say, back 13 or 14, they wrote, now it's a quote within a quote, because the American effort to integrate China into the liberal international order has now generated new threats to the U.S., primarily in Asia, and could result in a consequential challenge to American power globally, Washington needs a grand new strategy towards China that centers on balancing the rise of Chinese power rather than continuing to assist its ascendancy. Now, I quoted that from Cartellucci back in 2016, but it's a much older, at least a few years older, citation. Of course, the whole thing is absurd. This is a proclamation of imperialism. This is about domination. It's not protecting sea lanes or open trade. Open trade is the last thing that the oligarchy wants. It's about exploiting the region directly. But China is not a rock, something that the regime often forgets. China is a first world power willing and able to defeat a demoralized, bankrupt, and militarily overstretched America that hasn't been a superpower in a decade. China is, along with Russia, a huge part of the resistance against Western liberal imperialism. They seek to negotiate with Western banks as equals, not suppliants. But that's why the U.S. responds with greater threats. More concretely, China's power and economic potency make her claim to the South China Sea a matter of de facto right. She's already in the process of developing these islands, which automatically grants Beijing sovereignty over the Paracel and Spratlys chains, mentioned in that very same case. But doing so is no threat to anybody, unless the agenda is to maintain a colonial system there. Back then, suddenly the U.S. allies with Vietnam. China fought Vietnam in the region twice in the 1970s and 80s. And all of a sudden, Japan's neutrality or military limitations were thrown out. The Philippines were a willing participant in these drills in 2019 and 2020. Duterte, of course, has learned his lesson. And as I predicted, by the way, this is not from my paper, but they arrested him for his victory in the war on drugs. He has to fight now in the International Criminal Court. He actually won his war, and they arrested him. If anyone thinks that there's any war on drugs, that it exists at all at this point, again, he's one of these demonized leaders. However, he proved himself useful in the Chinese case. But now, as we stand here, I'm going back to my paper here, the majority of the American Navy is now engaged in the South China Sea. It's highly doubtful that Australia and the Philippines want war with the Chinese. Well, Vietnam is no longer in a position to challenge it, as it was the case in the 1980s. No interest is served for the war demands against China. Just like in 1940 and most of 1941 against Japan, the U.S. is in the process of trying to cut off China's access to certain raw materials. But Japan isn't China. Japan was a fairly small militarist hegemon facing a unified industrial giant. Instead, China is a legitimate superpower facing a dying empire. Very different relationship. I found one of the stupidest statements on this, and it comes from Mark Morris of the U.S. National War College. This is pure propaganda. He wrote this in November of 2013. Get this. War starts. The United States and its allies begin offshore controlling. Chinese seaborne imports and exports are reduced drastically. Factory production drops and millions of workers are laid off. Soon the numbers soar to tens of millions, perhaps 100 million. When jobs aren't found, they start protesting. Now the Chinese Communist Party is faced with tens of millions of unemployed protesters. It'll try to blame some enemy that can't be seen. Not believing the party, discontent grows and protests increase. The Chinese Communist Party orders the People's Liberation Army to break the blockade. But the army replies that China doesn't have the type of navy for that. The American blockade, that is. And are unable to comply with orders. Discontent grows and protests become more worrisome to the party leaders. The Chinese Communist Party declares that it has taught the foreign dog a lesson and seeks a peace conference at Geneva. Now, what I just wrote here, this idiot, Mark Morris, is saying what would happen if the U.S. were to, using its naval forces, cut China off from the South China Sea and most of its trade. He really thinks, A, the U.S. has that capability, and B, that that would happen. The entire thing is that this guy is at the U.S. National War College, and he lives in a fantasy world. This is all just a fantasy. None of this would happen. Even if he was right, none of this would happen. He's so stupid. He doesn't realize that all Beijing has to do is dump American dollars to refuse to finance American debt. Chinese population would never blame the West. Oh, I'm sorry. They would blame the West. They wouldn't blame their own leaders. They didn't instigate this war. But this is your typical American fantasy world. And it relies on the assumption that the U.S. has this power and that the world is unified in supporting American aims. This is not political analysis. Now, I talked about the dollar dump from the Chinese financial elite in 2004. And it's a slow but sure process for oil, other commodities. It could be catastrophic. Remember the tight control over information of the American media. The average American has no idea how many people are out of work or inflation or anything else. Now, I wrote back then, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China began operations in Moscow in mid-2017 with the sole purpose of being to act as a new intermediary for international commodity and energy trade. Iran already declared its intent to follow suit. At the end of 2015, the Russian Central Bank officially announced that the yuan has a reserve currency. It took a few more years to build the infrastructure for this shift. The only thing the U.S. could do was act militarily, and its buildup of forces is unprecedented. It has no financial weapons to answer the massive drop in demand for the dollar, or the fact that increasingly the U.S. only takes a fairly small percentage of Chinese exports. Russia already, and I wrote this, quite a while ago, almost 10 years ago, already had the mechanisms in place to build its own banking system. The big credit cards pulled out of Russia, so local alternatives have been exploding. Whatever dependency any kind of Western control of the regime had is gone. The SWIFT system, the computer module that governs international trade and credit, controlled by Western bankers from Belgium. Talk about it's a monster. It's a manifestation of the power of the global financial elites. They're all deeply in debt anyway. They're criminal enterprises. Removing Russia from their system has been nothing but a positive thing. Russia replaced it with the Mir. Used, now this is 2016, by 400 banks, maybe 2015. And it's used by SCO members on most occasions. Now, quietly, American Express and Citibank have tried to join with the Mir system. Most Northern European banks have done so too. Profits are more important than oil company demands, and a faction of the elite realize that there is no future in Western debt. The Mir structure is proof that Russia has removed the Rothschild-Fink presence from Russia. The minds behind the Great Reset thought BRICS was something you could guide and control, and they were wrong. Both major powers, China and Russia, are buying up gold at a breakneck pace. The export of precious metals is illegal in both countries now. Almost 50 million ounces of gold have been added to the SCO just in 2017. I, of course, added more to this paper as time went on, so it was first published in 2016. About 350 billion in treasuries have been dumped by the Chinese. It also helps that Russia is the world's third largest miner of gold. China is the first. You have this huge counter-revolution taking place right under the West's nose, and very few understand its nature. What the regime certainly understands is that liberalism itself is being directly challenged. Now, I wrote that, and then, of course, I added bits and pieces. This is the beginning of my book on China. So there's nothing, none of this that's happening now shocks me. Now, critics of China, they levy certain interrelated charges. The loudest complaint that China steals U.S. technology. Next, there's the accusation that the Chinese state, through its industrial policy, unfairly tilts the playing field by providing subsidies and financing to certain domestic firms. China has used policy to promote industries in the future with some success. China, for example, has become the major supplier of solar panels to the world market. Another gripe is that China has a significant sector of state-owned enterprises some of them high-tech industry, and some of which actively participate in the global market through exports and foreign direct investment. There's this grumble that China's state-owned enterprises have an unfair advantage due to their state backing and the fact that they're all actually Chinese. Neoliberal economic theory, as we already read, at this point has given up on any defeat of China. Neoliberal economic theory holds an industrial policy weakens a country's economy since it puts the state in the business of making decisions about what should be encouraged and what shouldn't be economically. Only the free market could do that, they say. But they also say that state-owned enterprises are inherently inferior to privately owned ones. They can only drag a company down, they're inefficient, or whatever. Yet, when confronted with China's massive advance, neoliberals suddenly forget all that, and they cry, unfair competition. Well, I thought state-owned enterprises couldn't function very well. Well, I guess that's just not true. China is not just independent. It dares to introduce a totally new system. Well, maybe not totally new. But I used to say that the difference between East and West is in the East, private companies are subservient to the interests of the state and hence the nation in the best of conditions. The West, it's the opposite. That's the total opposite of what's happening in the West. Of course, I've been saying that for God knows how long. Governments function and exist because of private companies. They're indebted to private companies. China's population is educated, enthusiastic, and productive. There's actual polls on happiness, and the Chinese blow the U.S. out of the water. When China was actually in competition with the West, it blew it out of the water. It won. It didn't have to plunder the world either. Didn't have to control foreign governments. Didn't have to starve anybody. That's unfair competition. Well, it's unfair, and we know why. Because China refuses to join and play by the old imperialist rules. Or it's not really rules. It's just the interest of the regime, of the oligarchy. The oligarchy doesn't understand systems or rules. It understands itself and its own interests, usually financial. But whether it be the Trump administration or Biden, and remember, these politicians aren't all that important when it comes to this stuff. All the trade wars that have occurred have backfired. Apple was complaining about it back before COVID, saying that the weak iPhone sales were somehow based on the trade war in Chinese, reducing its revenue forecast. They also said that the slump in purchases actually happened in China for the most part. Aaron Friedberg, of course, Princeton, you know, what a shocker, says this nonsense. This is what he gets paid for. America's post-Cold War strategy for dealing with China was rooted in prevailing liberal ideas about the linkages between trade, economic growth, and democracy, and a faith in the presumed universality and irresistible power of the human desire for freedom. The strategy pursued by China's leaders, on the other hand, was and still is motivated first and foremost by their commitment to preserving the Chinese Communist Party's monopoly on domestic political power. This is an this is the inside of the Ivy League. Now, I'm supposed to be impressed by this. A make-believe scholar who writes no differently than a New York Times editorial. Terms like monopoly on power are misleading. This monopoly on power is accepted by almost everybody over there and is incredibly successful. News reports that are always talking about the coming collapse of China or the coming collapse of Russia or Iran. This is just a means of projecting American failures onto its enemies. This is why not just, you know, Russia and China are surrounded with military bases. The country is completely broke, but still spending what little it has to defend Israel and, of course, now in the Far East. But why nationalist figures around Europe are going to prison. Anyone who tells this truth on a campaign trail, in other words, in front of millions of people, has to go to prison. China is libertarian compared to the Western world. Now, I wrote that a while ago. And you know, I've been saying it a lot longer than that. But I also said something else. I said the Americans need China more than reverse. China's exports grew in December of last year, 24. China's exports grew almost 11%. And of course, the analyst forecast, the expert forecast was much lower. Of course, they're always wrong. But what was the main driver of those exports? It was not the U.S. It wasn't the EU. It was the Third World. And they're connected with the Belt and Road Initiative. That's where the infrastructure is being sent. China's exports to the Third World exceeded its shipments to all the First World, Second World markets in 2023. Exports to the U.S. now, as of late 24, now are only 15% of China's total export shipments. 20% in 2018. 15%. This is not dependency. The greatest gain, and I didn't know this until recently, comes from Indonesia, who bought from China 50% more than December of 23. That's because China, the Belt and Road Initiative, is building a high-speed rail and telecommunications infrastructure. Same thing for Brazil, Vietnam, Kazakhstan. 20% increase in Kazakhstan. But any gain in export to the U.S. was small. That's because no one is buying. No one can. That means Washington's ability to pressure China through tariffs doesn't exist. As I said years ago, all China's going to do is shift to its own development of the Third World, which is increasingly not Third World anymore. And Indonesia is this huge standout. Of course, the fourth largest country in the world. Massive investments. Infrastructure, mining, so many other things. And mining, you know, of course, there's oil in Indonesia. It's a Belt and Road Initiative that the U.S. has no answer to. And I don't think can have any real answer to it. But what about military issues? Now, I said a lot of this before. It would be shocking to me if there's a direct war between the U.S. and China. The U.S. is going to lose, and they're going to lose quickly. Unless there's something going on behind the scenes that we don't know. It's going to be a naval war, if it exists. China has by far the world's largest navy, both quantitatively and qualitatively. 355 ships, with a lot more to come. They have a third and fourth carrier, which I think is a waste of money. I think aircraft carriers are obsolete, especially when it was the Chinese and the Russians who developed the hypersonic carrier killer missile. Not to mention long-range aircraft like the Su-35. So, if you're on my Patreon page, you know how many military articles there I've written about the collapse in training standards, everything from the service academies to the endless accidents, especially in the Navy and in the Air Force. The Connecticut incident, that was in 2021, the sub ran into an undersea mountain very close to China. But that's one of a long string of American submarine accidents. There's a journal called Fulcrum, specializing in Southeast Asia, a guy named Ian Story, I think he's British. He wrote that same year. He said this: "These mishaps highlighted troubling leadership, training, and maintenance issues exacerbated by the heavy operational demands placed on America's Pacific Fleet as it struggles to keep pace with China's naval activities in the region while at the same time maintaining a presence across the Western Pacific. China's Navy now has more battle force ships than its U.S. counterpart, operates Chinese new warships, and can focus on its activities in Northeast and Southeast Asia." He tries to console himself by saying, well, maybe they're not as capable of as U.S. vessels, which shows you he doesn't know anything. American vessels are falling apart. The U.S. Navy has already recognized this as a crisis. But it's more than that. China has the world's by far largest shipbuilding output. The U.S. doesn't have that capacity. I mean, it's just not that it can't do it, or that it won't do it. It can't do it. A few years, you're going to have 460 ships. If you read the work of retired Turkish Admiral Sem Gurdinz, G-U-R-D-E-N-I-Z, God knows how the Turks pronounce that. His work has been excellent. He was the head of the Plans and Policy Division of the Turkish Naval Forces, and then he was actually commander of the landing forces, which I'm assuming are the Marines. and hence was very close to NATO arming inside. Now, I've talked about the capacity issue. But it's not just warships, it's also the merchant ships. No warship could function for 2 seconds without a merchant fleet that supplies it. China has hundreds of times the capacity. The U.S. doesn't really have the ability to build ships anymore. China's merchant ship construction capacity is 232 times greater than the U.S. That's from the U.S. Naval Intelligence Directorate. And this is one of the big factors, according to the Admiral, that transformed the Chinese Navy the way it has. And the Chinese build the machinery, the electronics, the weapons, without being dependent on foreign sources. And all these companies are state-owned. They apparently do very well. It was Adam Smith who said, of all of the industries that should not be left to the free market, shipbuilding was one of them. So the U.S. left shipbuilding to the hands of the market. There are no military shipyards left in the U.S. There's a few civilian, I think there are 7 of them. There are about 200 in China. But full, you know, civilian shipyards of all kinds, there's almost 1,000 in China, more than 1,000 in China. The report, China's Naval Modernization, which came out with U.S. Congressional Research Service, August of last year. They say they will. And the U.S. is trying to build more ships, so there's a chance it's not going to happen. 2030, they'll have almost 450. And these are very cutting-edge new designs. If you follow this, the innovations are extraordinary. The Navy U.S. Navy has claims 296 in various conditions. But because they're overused, there's increasingly poor training. Only a small portion are capable of sailing. Now, Lisa Franchetti, who apparently is an admiral, who is a commander of U.S. naval forces, has tried to address this through Project 33. She says, we cannot create a larger conventional navy in a few years or focus only on numbers without the right capabilities to win the struggle for sea control. Even without these resources, you will improve our combat readiness, capabilities, and capacity. You must understand that the Navy faces serious financial and industrial constraints. Wait a minute. Sea control? I thought you were worried about the freedom of navigation. She even notes that even the civilian maritime construction in China could be switched over to military with ease. The last 20 years, the American Navy has shrunk by 20%. At the same time, China added another 165 cutting-edge warships. The 350 repair and maintenance facilities were closed in the U.S. and overseas bases after 1989. There's not that many left. The combat power of the U.S. Navy, this is November 4th of last year, again, 295, but that includes 60 auxiliary ships. 98 of those were deployed. Only 75% of those were functional. They don't split up which were auxiliary, which were combatant. So the number of combat ships on the move everywhere is 55, which is extremely poor. And you add to that, that to this day, half of naval aviation can't fly. Not to mention, not just the maintenance issues, but the pilot shortage. It's affected everybody. 98 out of 295 ships are deployed. Combat readiness is extremely low. It's 40%. Despite having the most massive defense budget in the universe, the sheer amount of money and political will, none of which exists, to bring this up to even combat ready status as of 10 years ago, well, it would be huge, and it's not there. In reserve, the reserve fleet, the average age is 40. And they're in poor condition. U.S. Naval, the navigation plan, which Project 33 is a part of, wants to increase that to 80%. But the planned maintenance and repair activities of the Navy, they're already 7 years behind schedule. They claim in this navigation plan that the Americans will be ready for Xi's declaration of war, or something stupid. They recognize that China has shot ahead, qualitatively and quantitatively. They are terrified. She makes a big deal about that the Chinese Navy has been designed specifically to defeat the American Navy. Well, whose fault is that? The U.S. has no right to be anywhere near there. Not to mention the ammunition issue. Air defense missiles, they're nowhere to be found. When you send everything to Ukraine, and then what's left to Israel, it's one attack. The Iranian attack in October of last year cost about $1 billion, and it wasn't even successful. I mean, the U.S. to fight back was $1 billion. That was said in the national interest in April of 24. Destroying Houthi and Iranian missiles cost the U.S. $1 billion. Now, that's not specifically just that October attack. If you remember, the Israelis, it was a retaliatory attack. But what he says is, the U.S., he says we, I don't know who we is, but the U.S. has countered more than 130 direct attacks on U.S. Navy ships and others over the last 6 months. The Navy has fired about $1 billion worth of air defense missiles to counter air threats from Iran and its proxies. There isn't much left in these stockpiles. These are hundreds of millions of dollars each. These are very expensive munitions. And so far, their use hasn't been the best. Not only the defense industry uses this in so-called Prosperity Guardian operation, but in the Red Sea and in the Far East. They have to protect carrier strike groups. And the JFK is supposed to be finished this year, but the planes don't exist for it. And yet, it doesn't really matter. China has this 8,000-mile DF-27 hypersonic anti-ship missile. Totally denial, area denial, anti-access weapon. The capacity to replenish these stocks isn't there right now. The U.S. is spending the missiles that it might want to use against China on the Mediterranean and the Red Seas. The short range SM-2 costs like $2 million each. The SM-6 are maybe $3.9 million each. But to produce one, it takes 2 years at the fastest. And they're used by 13 countries, including Turkey. And Russia is far and away superior in missile technology right now. U.S. doesn't have the capacity for any of this. To create a sea bridge to supply, whether in the Atlantic or the Pacific, the merchant fleet isn't there. The U.S. only has 200 ships for this purpose. The auxiliary ship fleet, the MSC, Military Sealift Command, has very limited resources. The U.S. has 19 fleet support ships, 14 ammunition transports, 15 military supply transport ships. You know how many China has? 5,500 of all of those ship types. The physical material isn't there to supply any war in Asia. The wartime load of just a mechanized division alone is 100,000 tons. The cargo needed for even the first couple of months of the war is about 25 million tons. That has to be shipped over. 100 million barrels of petroleum. That was a few years ago. And that was in Europe. In the Pacific theater of operations, where distances are far longer, the physical ships, the men, the money, it's not there. The U.S. can saber rattle all at once. It can't fight a war without these support ships. It can't fight a war with dwindling supplies. With China is to the brink. This is what happens. You know, China's in a position they're in because they don't have an empire. They're not pretending to police and dominate the world. They haven't had to exploit anybody. Only the regime has to do that. The problem cannot be solved with the current resources. So either the regime will reduce its claims to rule the world, which is out of the question, or B, it'll use proxies, fraud, hoaxes, false flags to get its way. Maybe there is a C, the use of nuclear weapons. I tend to doubt that, but it is conceivable. Congress even said this. 2024, the Pentagon's Transportation Command, completely insufficient. The sea lift that would last for months in the Pacific. And the need to protect those support convoys against first world threats, no less. Every ship, except for the nuclear ones, needs to refuel at sea several times. Where is this going to happen? The ships aren't there for this kind of thing. You know, their standard missile loads, the surface ships will exhaust it on the first day of the war. Especially if it's a two-front one. Stocks are already depleted. They're going to deplete very quickly. The transfer of these missiles, manufactured in the U.S. to the Navy, and loading them onto ships in the Pacific theater, under the Chinese missile threat, that's a completely separate problem. They can't do it. This is a problem. If a dent were taken out of this, it would require a 20% budget increase, which is simply not going to happen. The payment on interest alone is ridiculous. This is what happens. 40% of American submarines are under repair. Many of them are simply not trusted, given the huge number of accidents. If conflict with China was to break out tomorrow, there is no doubt the American Navy would be rapidly defeated. The logistical difficulties alone of building and sustaining American naval power in the short and medium terms are incredible, over huge distances, and way beyond the American capacity to sustain. That doesn't even include replenishing weapons and ammunition stocks. This means the regime is starting fights that its U.S. golem, in no way can it win. Unless there's some fraud, they have a faction in the military over there, that it has to be something like that. The U.S. Navy cannot maintain its bases and allies in the Pacific region and its transoceanic logistical support line. It can't do it. The ships aren't there. The money's not there. The production isn't there. None of it is there. The maintenance isn't there. Guam used to have a dry dock. It doesn't exist anymore. There's very few of those left. You could have 11 nuclear aircraft carriers. That's fine when more than half your planes can't fly and there's no pilots and there's no maintenance and there's no money and there's no ammunition to defend them. People don't realize just the ridiculous, how, you know, putting one of these anti-missile weapons together, it takes a long time. People forget you have to make them, you have to load them, you have to ship them over and hope that an enemy doesn't destroy them. That requires a huge outlay. A huge outlay of everything, none of which the U.S. has. So they could saber rattle, they could threaten, they could scream and yell. This is why the Chinese say we are ready for any war, economically and militarily. The U.S. can't win. It's conceivable that the regime has something else in mind, something really nasty. You could never underestimate their irrationality. The truth is, the U.S. has no right to be in any of these places in the first place. It doesn't have the money, equipment, the men, the political will to effectively run an empire, and certainly one where there is a major war. American tough talk is talk, again, but you should never underestimate the irrationality of the regime. China's advantage, economically and militarily, is overwhelming. The U.S. is, in fact, a paper tiger, especially when it's threatening the Chinese. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.